Welcome to Shoe Swap Food Conversations on CKVS 93.7 FM, the voice of the Shoe Swap. Host Warren Bell is here with a new season of local, regional, and international guests in conversation about getting our food system back to local, nutritious, high-quality foods that promote health, wellness, and sustainable communities. Now, here's your host, Warren Bell, to introduce today's guest.
And welcome again to Food Conversations Season 4. We're going to start off, of course, as always, by acknowledging that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepemec people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for us all. So today I'm delighted to welcome once again Nicolette Richer to our studio via Zoom from Whistler, BC, to talk about some of her accomplishments and to explore the numerous food-centered projects she's been starting up and nurturing over the last number of years. Welcome, Nicolette.
Thank you very much. A pleasure to be here. And I just want to acknowledge that I'm on the beautiful, unceded, unsurrendered territories of the Squamish and the Lillooet Nation peoples. And we thank them for keeping our lands clean and pristine for millions of years.
And being available to teach us lots of stuff that we don't know about the world, that when we listen to them, we'll make some steps, firm steps forward. So I'm going to start off by summarizing Nicolette's trajectory up to this point. So Nicolette, you're just going to have to listen to me nattering away for a while. Now, if you haven't yet listened to our show from last week, Nicolette's roots are in Africa, in Malawi, a landlocked country known widely as the Warm Heart of Africa because of the wonderfully friendly people there. And she's a perfect example of that, by the way, where she lived with her mother of African and Indian heritage who had a child by an Austrian development officer. And that's Nicolette. She lived there till she was four, until her mother fell in love with a Canadian from East Vancouver and he fell in love with her. And they all moved to BC's Lower Mainland and eventually ended up with a farm in Pemberton and living and working in Whistler. Along the way, she earned a tennis scholarship at the University of Mississippi. Now, I just threw that in, Nicolette, so that people know that you're a woman of parts. And then began a psychology program at Simon Fraser University until a gap year in India changed everything and compelled her to enter the world of sustainability. That internal movement took place. That led her back to Simon Fraser to take an interdisciplinary studies BA with a diploma in sustainable community development in 2004. And I might add, when I was going to school, there were no degrees like this, and I wish there had been. And then she went on to a master's degree in environmental education in 2009 from Royal Roads University, where she is now pursuing a PhD in social sciences. Now, this little intro gives you an impression that Nicolette is an academic who sits in the halls of learning, and that's her gig. But in fact, that's not it at all. Her blurb on the Royal Roads website calls her a serial entrepreneur and health educator, and I think that's a much more accurate description of where Nicole's head and heart are located. So now, Nicolette, did you hear anything that was wrong in that intro?
No, that was pretty bang on.
Well,
yeah,
there you are. I've been listening.
Kind of just telling me to. I probably need to take a break. Now, hearing that, I'm like, I need a vacation.
I'm tired. Oh well, I'll never say that again. I promise. Anyway, so let's get into the heart of where you focused your abundant energies, the many projects and enterprises that you've initiated in the broader community. Now. For a while, you actually worked as a civil servant, and that you were soon disabused of the joys of civil service work, and you were developing policies and programs around sustainability. But you knew that you wanted to do something completely different, and it had to do with food. And a particular link to your best friend Erica's father and the use of metabolic nutrition, that's where things kind of got percolating, as far as I recall. And that's something eventually morphed into something called Richer or Richer Nutrition. That play on words, we'll be talking about this all the way through the show. It's such a great play on words. So tell us more about that how food sort of invaded your life. It had always been there, but it gradually morphed into a formal sort of occupational direction?
Yeah, I mean, I was the kid that would sit in grade three class smelling the Chef Boyardee being eaten by the kid next to me. And I'd be like, how come I never get that? Because my mom had a garden. And, you know, we talked about that in the last show. And so, you know, I grew up eating whole foods just because of, you know, my ancestry and where my mom and I came from. So I didn't really think much about food. So while I was doing environmental work in government, and doing a lot of research on toxins and, you know, having to keep our soils healthy, our air healthy, water healthy, I wasn't really connecting the links between our diet and our health until I lived with Erica and her dad was diagnosed with cancer. And he was given 3 months to live. Bill was 72 years old at the time, you know, high functioning, a serial entrepreneur as well. And he wasn't given any other options, no chemo, no surgery, no radiation. So he ended up turning to this program, metabolic nutritional therapy, intense nutrition, intense detoxification, and he was cancer-free within less than a year. And he ended up living another 22 more years. So that is what launched me into being the, I guess, curious person that I am, to try and understand this therapy on a scientific level, on, you know, an artistic level, on all levels, truly.
Right. And Richer Nutrition, 2008. How did that come to be?
Yeah, so fast forward a few years, you know, when I was looking at the food that Bill was eating, I didn't dive deeply into it at that moment, but, you know, we started eating 100% organic and we grew our food. We did all of that. But, you know, it was small little baby steps I was taking until another friend, a real dear friend, her mom was diagnosed with cancer for the second time, again, metastasized through her body. And I immediately said, you have to connect with Bill. So I put the two of them together. And of course, Bill was just like, do the therapy. And Emma was like, well, how do I do that? I'm dying right now. And so I, 3 days later, got on a plane, flew to San Diego. They happened to be teaching a workshop on the therapy. And the minute I was there and they started to explain how it worked, I was in. This science made 100% complete sense. Being that I already had that environmental science background, this was now a human body science, you know, that mm-hmm. completely the links were all connected. And then I went back to San Diego, got trained over the next year to be able to teach the therapy to other people. And then Richer Health was born from there when my local government asked me to teach all of our employees during a health and wellness week what the therapy was about.
What was that like, sort of turning the tables on, not financially, like, but on your employer, to have them, instead of you working their part of the street, you were working your own side of the street?
Yeah, number one, it was incredible that they even asked me, because I don't even think they knew what they were asking of me, because when I put that first presentation together, it was like, how, you know, the 10 steps you need to take to reverse cancer and chronic disease using food as medicine. And then what happened after that was actually pretty spectacular, because so many of the employees that attended that workshop, they started to come back to me over the next, you know, few weeks and months and saying, you know, they didn't suffer from migraines. They weren't suffering from their, you know, chronic bowel, you know, conditions. They, you know, diabetes was gone. Mental health conditions were being alleviated. And that was when, like, the light just went off. And I just knew that that was the end of my career in government. And that was the launch of Richer Health.
Mm. And that led to a lot of activities, teaching, doing workshops, presentation, that kind of thing. Now, one part that morphed out of that was Richer Health, Nutrition, and Detox Wellness Center. Now, that's a bit of a mouthful, but it's a description of a very specific thing that you did.
Yeah, so, you know, fast forward, I'd had clients from all over the world. We had our, you know, restaurants opened, and then people were calling and saying, can we come to you so you can teach us this therapy, you know, firsthand, one-on-one. And so that's when I knew we had to have a medical clinic in Canada where people could go to. A lot of people who do nutritional therapies, they often fly to Mexico because that's where legally medical doctors can actually teach and prescribe nutrition. And so what was happening is that I saw that a lot of my clients, they couldn't afford to do that. They didn't want to be away from their families. And so they said, well, what if I flew to you and we did it, you know, in Canada, or drove to me. And so that's what happened. We opened up that center. It was a 12-bed center. People would come, they would fly in. We would hand them a carrot apple juice the minute they walked in the door. Then we'd move into, you know, 15 hours of lectures over the next few days. I would teach them how to cook again. A lot of people had never held a potato in their hand. They don't maybe have held French fries or, you know, potato flour, but they had never actually, you know, had to chop leeks and cabbage. And so we had them making all the food. That was one of the requirements. And then I would teach them the science of nutrition and detoxification to reverse disease. They would send me their lab results beforehand. We would, you know, make sure there was no contraindications. And then the people would go home, apply this in their life, and they come right again, right back and say, oh my gosh, my cancer markers are, you know, down 90%. My, you know, inflammatory markers are, you know, normalized, heart conditions, everything, just, you know, the diseases melt away.
Your retreat center or your workshop center has an interesting history as well. It was it's where you used to live. Now
Yes.
you're in the garage. You've given up your home and taken on the garage. I think listeners need to understand that this is an intensely personal story, like all of their stories. This is something that isn't always addressed, is the fact that people don't just, you know, buy into a program and then it flies. There's lots of interesting kind of changes of direction. So this was your farm.
Yeah, it was only a small farm, 1 acre of agricultural land in Pemberton. And we bought it specifically to open the wellness center. We knew we wanted to, we were in a very, very tiny, tiny apartment with our three kids, my husband, my au pair, who was helping us take care of the kids and cook healthy food. And so we decided to upgrade. But the minute I saw this property, I saw the potential because it had the main house. And then it also had this four, you know, concrete block cylinder garage. And immediately I said, okay, well, my family can live in the garage. We'd have all this outdoor space on 1 acre of like beautiful farmland. And then the house would become the wellness center. So that's what we did. We built the garage into a house in I think it was 4 weeks, and the whole place was built. And then we moved in on Christmas Day. Just so we could open up the retreat center and start making money, because we had three mortgages on the place to make all of this work. It was quite, quite the endeavor.
What's that like? I mean, a lot of people who come in this show have been people who they're not entrepreneurs of the Elon Musk category. They're working on the ground level and dealing with the kinds of things you're just describing. What's it like to start up a venture like that? You had a pretty good idea that there was a lot of interest or enough interest to make it fly. But living in a garage with three children and three mortgages, you have as many mortgages as you have children. Interesting thought.
Yes.
What kind of state of mind does that put you in? I mean, it must speed up the sense of movement in your life.
Oh, it's, you know, I say naivete is what has gotten me through all of this, because even when we opened up our restaurants, I, you know, never. I didn't don't even really like being in the kitchen. Never worked in a kitchen before. So it definitely pushes you to do things immediately. Like, you have to use your intuition, you have to use your gut, you have to just, you know, reach out for help and ask mentors to say, hey, listen, how do I do this? And you can't do it all yourself, so you just end up delegating. So you find the people who can, you know, support you and help you and make it happen, because at the end of the day, you still have the bills to pay, and so the money has to be there. And also, you know, you just launch it into the world and maybe blindly pray that people are going to purchase, you know, spots at this wellness center. But they did. It was incredible, and people came from all over the world.
Now, we've dropped a hint a couple of times about the restaurants. So let's talk a little bit about that, because that is, unlike teaching, where, you know, there are a lot of a lot of his intellectual activity. This is a very practical process. But you didn't get into the restaurant business directly for its own sake. You got in because you were at that point thinking of going to medical school, which listeners probably realize these days is a process where you have to pay your way. I might comment, I'm a family physician since the mid-70s, and I have a totally different experience. I had all my studies paid for, so that when I left medical school, as I've told many people, my indebtedness to my undergraduate program, bachelor in music and creative writing, I had more debt from that than I had from medical school. But my colleagues now in medicine have $250,000 to $500,000 indebtedness. And you were staring at that. You were thinking going into medicine because it seemed like some way to do something, but do something concrete. But it didn't work out that way. And the world is your world, and the rest of the world is richer. Sorry, I can't get away from that word, richer, as a result of it. But tell us about why you started the restaurant and its connection with your medical school aspirations.
Yeah, when I was working in government and then learning about the Gerson therapy, which is a therapy that I teach, I knew I had to teach it to the world. And I thought that the best place to do that would be as a physician, and that I could, you know, see patients all day long, and then, you know, they'd come in with their heart disease, diabetes, autoimmune disorders, infertility. And I would say, hey, listen, let's change your lifestyle. Let's change your diet. Let's, you know, restore those nutrient deficiencies, et cetera. So that was the clear path, and it hit me like a ton of bricks the day my daughter was born. And it was in the hospital, and I knew I wanted a career change, and I knew it had to involve being in the healthcare field. And my midwife said, what about becoming a doctor? So that was it. I started reading everything. A friend of mine was a doctor. I called her up. I said, okay, how do I do this and make this happen? And I applied for my first pre-med sciences course at Thompson Rivers University.
Isn't it interesting that your midwife suggested you become a doctor, and in the social hierarchy of our culture here, didn't say you could become a midwife and then you could really, you get kids started off, you know, with the best nutrition from the day they were conceived. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's just an aside that struck me as a physician.
Well, she's an amazing midwife. And she said, with three kids, you can't be a midwife. Like being on call, you know, 24/7, she said, you know, I wouldn't have the time with the family that she knew that I wanted. So she thought med school would be a good option.
And even there, there's a certain irony, because at one point in time, physicians used to attend childbirth on a regular mm-hmm. basis, but now it's almost become a tiny wedge in the medical pie, and very, very much mm-hmm. sort of almost on the side. So there you were. Your midwife says, do it. And of course, you do everything your midwife says. So you said, let's go for it. So you went for it.
Well, it was, you know, and to tell you the truth, I went for it. And it wasn't even that, it was that what she said connected all my dots in my life. And I was like, I've always been meant to be a doctor. And to this day, it's actually one of my biggest, it's not regrets. I never will call it that, because it all worked out perfectly. I love that I did my pre-med sciences. I excelled in them, even though I was terrible in sciences while I was in high school and university. And so it was amazing. I got exceptional grades. I had these three little babies, but I could just study all day long. Loved it. Everything connected. And so, but the problem was, we had no money. Like, we literally were living paycheck to paycheck. My husband was a teacher. I was working in government, and, you know, just 3 days a week now by this point. Actually, I was on mat leave. So we didn't have the money. And so I had to pay for it somehow. And a friend of mine, she had owned a restaurant in Whistler, a little cafe. And 2 years later, she sold it. And she had, you know, sold it, I think, for like $250,000. And I was like, perfect. That's the exact amount I need to go to med school. So if she could do it, I could do it. So that's when, and, you know, again, my clients by this point were asking me to make them food, and they would constantly ask me if I would do meal plans and drop off meals for them and do their juicing for them, et cetera. And there was no way that I could do that. But I knew that if I had a team in a restaurant, they could do it, and then my clients could just all go there. So it all seemed to come together that way in this. Absolutely. Like, I look back as I'm telling the story and I'm like, life usually doesn't happen just like that.
Isn't it interesting?
But it did in a way.
You also said, I got a team, and there was sort of an openness to involving this with having other people involved with it and other people becoming involved. They wanted to become involved. That kind of a notion that you just can't address all these issues completely on your own. You have to have people who have their skill sets, that their expertise, their knowledge and experience that make it work.
Oh, well, yeah. And I, immediately went out and looked for other restaurateurs to ask about their experience opening up restaurants. And one individual, Sue Adams, she's owned multiple grocery stores and businesses in our community. And she said, Nikki, if you want to build this cafe so you can sell it and go to med school, she said, do not ever learn how to use the till or make the food. And so what she was saying is work on the business, not in the business. And it was the best piece of advice that I could be given. So it was fantastic. I never had to give up my health consulting business. I got to be with my kids every time they needed them. I had this team working in the cafe who loved, we had people coming from all over the world once they knew that we opened up a 100% organic plant-based whole food cafe. And they said, we want to work for you. And so it was like a magnet.
And what kind of people did you magnetize? What kind of people did you get in?
Okay, so this is going to floor you. So we had everybody from dietitians, lawyers, doctors. We had nurses. We had engineers. Then we had, people would say the hippies of the world who just believed in, organic food and clean living and peace and love. We had, we had all walks of life coming through. It was just the most beautiful, beautiful thing. And, and so many of those team members that we had, they're like our family now.
So were they all age groups, different kinds of cultural backgrounds and nationalities, that kind of thing?
Yeah, we have our manager, she rode her bike across Canada to come work for us. So she was in France when she Googled healthy restaurants in Canada, and she found ours. So she called us up and she said, I'm going to come from France. Canada, come work for you.
This is too joyful. I'm not sure I can handle this.
Oh, people from Ireland, Australia. We had, just from everywhere. It was incredible. And Whistler is a place that attracts people already from all over the world.
It's got a visible profile.
So, yeah, exactly. And, but lots of people who said, we'll work for you for free. Some of the most incredible people who really wanted a career change as well. So they wanted to get out of their existing profession and learn about health and wellness and nutrition. And we also, when we launched, we made sure people knew that first and foremost, we were an education center and a health hub. It was a place you could come if you had chronic disease and learn about metabolic nutrition for the reversal of chronic disease. So we ran workshops in the evenings. In the restaurant itself, yes. And so people knew us as that in addition to just being a restaurant. And what was beautiful too is that, Whistler's a place that has a lot of second homeowners and people who were eating in the community for years and years and years. They actually wouldn't eat out in restaurants until we opened. And we were the first restaurant that a lot of people ate at because they said they would never sacrifice eating in a place that served high sodium, high oil foods, that's not organic. So all of these people came out of the woodwork as well and would eat in our cafe 7 days a week. It was wild. I was like, what are you doing here? Exactly. But it really showed how many people were out there that valued good food, but they just weren't able to access it.
So you were tapping into a void in the restaurant food served outside your own home world. It was clear that you were tapping into an aspiration that was widespread and in lots of people. I mean, not everybody, but in people from all over the place. This was not a local phenomenon, but very much the restaurant had a local base. For example, you made a real effort to source food locally. Talk about that, because that's a process in itself.
Yeah. And when we opened the restaurant, you'll love this story. I had no idea that you had to apply and submit a credit application to your suppliers to be able to get the food that you needed. I mean,
And what was your
live and
credit?
learn.
Like three mortgages and three children, and we're living in a garage. And could you please give us lots of support?
Exactly. So I had no idea. So they said, oh, well, it'll take a few weeks to for us to process this. Meanwhile, we were opening the next day. So I had my list of suppliers and I, and anyway, so they said, well, if you drive down to Vancouver, you can pick up from the farms, you can pick up from the distribution center, the organic distribution center, and the farmers in Pemberton were like, sure, we'll deliver in a few weeks. You have to get your orders in like much further in advance. So it was a bit of a rocky start, but I did. I drove to Vancouver, I loaded up our Dodge Caravan with 2,000 pounds of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds. Drove back.
I have a feeling that exceeds the GVW, the gross vehicle weight limit for
It
Dodge
does.
Caravan.
It's only 1,500, and I actually had to call Dodge from the distribution center and say, will I break my car if I put 2,000 pounds of vegetables in here? I had a bag, 20-pound bag of carrots sitting on the dashboard, and my daughter was in her car
Oh
seat,
my God.
smothered in vegetables.
Mother abuses daughter with bag of carrots.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Risks life of
Oh,
tiny human.
it.
Oh
That
my
would have
goodness.
been quite the, yeah. So we just slowly started developing relationships with our local farmers. They had to quadruple their production because they weren't used to selling, 48 heads of romaine a day to restaurants. Normally, restaurants would purchase, a small few pounds of baby carrots to garnish their steaks. Whereas we were the opposite. Our plates are 100% vegetables and whole grains and everything. So that made the farmers have to just reconsider their crops for the following year. So we just skimmed by the first year with enough produce, and then after that, everybody was able to produce enough for us.
Just remind listeners that I'm talking today with Nicolette Richer, who is a serial entrepreneur and food advocate in every way from Whistler, BC, and has been teaching metabolic nutrition for many years. And that's the focus of what we're talking about right now. Nicolette, your farmer, what became your farmer colleagues, what was it like for them, apart from the fact that they had to ramp up their production, what was it like for them to have somebody like you with a restaurant like yours coming to them? You had these other people coming to work for you. What was it like for these growers when they suddenly, well, not suddenly, but over time, realized that there was a serious destination in their own bailiwick for the food that they were growing?
Oh, it was beautiful because it's just a strict economics issue. It's supply and demand. So all of a sudden they had this demand and they had to meet the supply. And so immediately once the first growing season was over, they came to us and they said, we're planning for next year. How many rows of this do you need? How many rows of that do you need? What else can we grow for you? So even the grocery stores would call us up and say, from teaching the workshops even. So we would teach people that they needed to up their volume of vegetables and fruits. So then the people would leave our workshop, go to the grocery store to find collard greens and celeriac root and all these, diversity of foods. So even the grocery store had to call us and say, give us the heads up when you teach a workshop so we can actually meet the demand for these vegetables. And then they started asking us to supply recipe cards in the grocery store so that people could put recipes together with all the foods because they were getting all of these questions that they couldn't answer. So between the farmers and the produce managers, it was awesome to see just how quickly they started getting additional vegetables, fruits, everything. And then, of course, it was brilliant because then the production produce managers were going to the farmers that we were sourcing from and then increasing their supply. So the farmers also got to distribute more to the grocery stores.
You know, Nicolette, it does sound, as you're describing this scenario, it does sound like what was really going on was changing a culture in a community, or perhaps drawing out elements in the culture that had been either neglected or not somehow addressed. People, coming from all over the world to work, but also growers saying, okay, I'm going to ramp up. Maybe I'm doing it for economic reasons, but I'm also doing it because I think it's the right thing to do. They weren't going for a Save-On, a Safeway, a Super Value grocery store that's, or you know, said we'll send us a reefer truck with 10 million cabbages once a week, and you're our supplier. These were people fairly small scale, but nevertheless going to down the road, as it were, to drop off their produce rather than putting in on a train and having it go somewhere else far away. Did you have a sense that you were involved in this kind of process of social transformation and changing the structure and the infrastructure of the community?
Yeah, and it hit me immediately when the farmers came to us and said that they had to increase their crop production, and a light bulb went off in my head, and I thought, okay, for every green mustache, if it takes small, you know, four small medium farms times XXX, you know, so I started doing the math, and it wasn't just about the food, it was about growing organic food, what that does to the soil, because these were very mindful organic farmers. And so then in addition to that, it, you know, I knew that food production and distribution is one of the biggest contributors to climate change. So I thought, okay, well, what if we had little green mustache cafes in every small town and city across Canada, then they have to source from four surrounding farms, and they force them to, you know, turn over their crops to organic farmland. And so then, oh my gosh, this is the way we heal the planet. So that's what happened when I decided to start franchising. And it was because of that. Like, I got into this, you know, teaching metabolic nutrition because it wasn't just about human health. It was about planetary health. To have a healthy human body, you have to have a healthy landscape around you and a healthy planet. So the two, it was my direct path to climate change, you know, support and reduction. So
franchising is an interesting exercise in expanding what you're doing in a local scale. How did that proceed? What kind of experience was that?
Yeah, we opened up our own corporate store. Our second store was a corporate store in Vancouver and Kitsilano, close to Banyan Books. And that was an experience that taught me I didn't want to run individual restaurants. So someone suggested franchising. So I, you know, of course, called up franchisers and, you know, and said, hey, teach me the world of franchising in 24 hours or less, because I need to make a decision. And they did. So we had, you know, hired one of the best to support us in setting up our franchise system. And that was interesting because it requires a completely different skill set. This is now you're working with people, you have to train people, you have to, you know, make sure you get the right franchise franchisees. And I love that we did go down that route. It was a very challenging route in a lot of ways because we attracted all of these very passionate individuals. But what I didn't realize is that my husband and I are really, really good at if being super efficient, being really savvy, being, you know, thinking on our own two feet very quickly. We're good at problem solving. We can handle a lot of stress. We, you know, if the dishwasher blows and it's spewing hot water across the restaurant, we just go, okay, let's fix it. And so we attracted all of these incredible, beautiful franchisees, but we thought they'd have their restaurants open in less than 3 months like we did. But it took a lot longer. It was like going on a year before some of these restaurants would get open. Also, we realized that the restaurant was built and successful because of our location, but also because of me teaching the workshops in the restaurants, which then attracted clients. So we never had to do marketing. So there was a lot of elements to the franchise development that, I mean, I learned a ton. It was brilliant, and it's a beautiful model, but it was another skill set. And having three kids, the wellness center, I'm doing consulting, I'm traveling to China to teach physicians, and I'm running a franchise business. It was pretty, I would say at this point, chaotic.
It was impossible.
It was impossible to be truly successful at anything. And that's been a hard lesson for me. Like that's been my hard pill to swallow, is that I can't do it all really well. But so now, of course, we're refocusing on how we do this.
So you now have the whole sort of franchising end is managed by another kind of team that takes that on. Is that how it works?
Well, I wish I could say that, but no. So we had 4 locations, and speaking about franchising, at the end of the day, it's another human that is running the business, and life happens. One of our franchisees, she lost a baby at 25 weeks, and that was really hard. And said she wanted to charge forward with the restaurant, which she did. That was a beautiful location. But then she got pregnant again and ended up giving birth in the same month that she opened a restaurant. So that was like, so she said, I need to focus on my baby. And of course she did. Another franchisee, she was actually attacked. She was attacked at the beginning of a COVID. Somebody punched her in the face and said, take COVID back to your country, even though she's Filipino, not from China. And regardless, who does that? And, you know, she ended up really breaking down from that. She had already had lost her mom recently. And, you know, so then that location closed. And then we're back down to only our 2 corporate stores. We were up to 7 locations and now we're down to 2. And now we have 10 opening up in New York. So it's quite the dance, but we're figuring it out.
When somebody walks into your store, your restaurant / store / educational center in Whistler, what do they see when they come in?
Ooh, they're going to see a lot of busy bees in the kitchen. We have an open concept kitchen for the most part. So when people come in, they can see, 25 heads of romaine and 30 stacks of collard greens, and people making our blending buckwheat groats into flour. They can see people sitting around just eating like the food is gorgeous because it's all phyto-rich, phytochemical-rich nutrient food. And so it's just colorful. They can see a zero-waste store that's in our retail section. So people can come in and buy any one of our 110 ingredients. They can buy it at in the retail section, and everything's in glass jars that they can return, or they can bring in their own containers and stock them up with raw ingredients. What else do they see? They see incredible staff. Like, our team is amazing. Like, we have the best humans in the world working for us. So they just see people who want to serve them healthy, delicious, nutrient dense food.
So it's a complete sort of open concept. You walk in and you see the people cooking the food, the people eating the food, the information and purchases that they can make over in some corner as well. So it's all right out there for them to see.
Yeah, a lot of people describe it as their home away from home. They feel like they're just going into their parents' house. They're there to, eat together, commune together. People would used to tell us all the time, we smelt this like amazing smell coming down the street, and it smelt like my grandmother's cooking. And they would follow their noses, end up in our restaurant. And these are people who are not plant-based eaters. They're used to, eating expensive steaks and whatnot. And then they would just become fans of our restaurant. They would come there because they realized it was easier to get us to put like 20 ingredients into a meal for them versus them go and buy all those ingredients, chop them up, wash them, do all of that, cook them. And so, yeah, we just turned a lot of people into vegetable eaters.
If you just tuned into the show, you're listening to Food Conversations, and my guest today is Nicolette Richet from Whistler, and we're talking about her Green Mustache restaurants, which have expanded, contracted, and are expanding again in North America, but are based on this principle, which I think we're kind of touching into now, of a kind of openness across the board. Information about everything that's going on is there. It's not something where you walk in and you don't see where the food is produced. And as everybody, I think, who's ever worked in a restaurant, a typical restaurant in a typical kind of conventional setting is an intense place. The cooking part is often a scene for a lot of tensions, a lot of stresses. People, cooks can be notoriously cranky, you're not selected for personality when you become a cook, but it's because everything's out in the open, and everybody's can see what's going on. Was that something you were thinking of as you set up the residence? You want to impart a certain spirit?
Yeah, and it was deliberate right from the get-go that we wanted that open concept kitchen because we wanted to see people, we wanted our customers to see how hard our staff work to prepare the food. We wanted them to see that kitchens don't have to be these dirty places in the background, but that we're exceptionally clean at the same time. We wanted them to see how many nutrients were going into a glass of vegetable juice, because we also have cold press juicing. And a lot of people often say like, oh, it's so expensive to eat healthy. But you know, it's not actually more expensive to eat healthy. It's usually on par with going and getting a meal that's most likely going to create heart disease down the road or diabetes. So you're paying the same price, but you're paying for health, but you're also paying for the labor that goes into it. We wanted people to see like the gorgeousness of the food that these farmers were producing. Like often our farmers pick the food at like 5 a.m, show up in their rubber boots at 7:38. They'd have to fight their way through the customer lineups because people would be there for their breakfast in the morning. And then the farmers like, you know, throwing down, you know, 50, 60, 70 pounds of, you know, gorgeous greens and diversity of food. So we wanted it to be like that on purpose. People have to see where their food comes from, because we live in a world where nobody knows where food comes. They think it comes from aisle 7 in the grocery store.
Yeah. I truly do sense that this is, and I'm thinking of the general run of people that we've interviewed on the show. A lot of people who really want to have a different relationship with food, and they want to have a different relationship with the people who grow the food. And in the case of, a restaurant or a cafe, they want to have an idea who's doing it. They want to see what's going on. It sounds like that's really struck a very responsive chord in a lot of people's minds.
Oh, it has. And we've seen, you know, we're going into our 10th year now of having the restaurant. I didn't even think I'd ever make it past the first year, because it was so much work to the point that I actually ended up burning myself out in year 3. So I didn't think we'd ever make it to 10 years. And every year I just go, wow, like another year. And over that decade, we have seen a massive transformation in our community. Like we've watched other restaurants and cafes producing very similar meals to what we produce. They all have gorgeous plant-based, whole food, nutrient-dense desserts now instead of the typical muffins and croissants that are served in a lot of places. And so it has, I've seen the effect that it has had on people. And I don't think, I don't want to say it's all because of us. There's been a global transformation and movement towards better eating over the last decade. But, you know, when you have customers eating in our place 7 days a week, it's only a matter of time before they go to other locations and say, could you actually add some better menu items to your menu, which we actually would inspire our customers to go tell the other restaurants, because I want a diversity of places to eat as well. Like I just don't always want to have to eat in our cafe every single day, even though we do.
Now, among your customers in the Green Mustache restaurants were physicians in the community, doctors, and they, just like many of your other customers, were enthusiastic eaters. They wanted to eat the food that you had to serve, and they liked the atmosphere in the restaurant, and they came to learn some of the things you had to teach about metabolic nutrition. And you know, and I certainly know because I've been in this line of work for a long time, that nutrition and the effect of nutrition on human health has been absent from medical training pretty much forever. Or perhaps it was there in Hippocrates' day, because Hippocrates said, let your food be your medicine and your medicine be your food. But somewhere along the line, it didn't come through from the Greek into the rest of the other languages of the world. And so we don't do that. We physicians get no training in nutrition to speak of during our medical learning experience. And so your physician colleagues and customers said, guess what? It'd be a disaster if you actually went into medicine, because you'd be hamstrung. You'd have no opportunity to express these ideas and concepts. And so that really ended up fortunately kiboshing the whole intention that was underlying the formation of the Green Mustache Restaurant. And then that's not only did that stop that, it's led to other things. And I want to talk a little bit about the Sea to Sky Thrivers, which you started up in about 2013. It's an expansion of some of the things we've been talking about with respect to the restaurants.
Yeah, so after a few years of, it had been about 3 years of running the restaurants, and I was looking at the, you know, when I started the restaurants, I had just passed my MCAT the same month that we opened up our restaurant, or a couple within the same time period. And I was really set on going to med school. And so, and then of course we decided not to once we started to open up more locations. And I was looking at our audience, and what really bothered me is that we were serving predominantly a homogeneous customer base. And I mean, it is Whistler. There's a lot of Caucasian individuals from multiple European, Australian, rest of Canada societies. But we were not serving Indigenous people. And it would really strike me very starkly when one of our Indigenous members from Mount Currie Band or Squamish Lillooet Nation would come in and eat. And I would like be like, that's the first Indigenous person in our restaurant in like 2 years. And I was also at the same time thinking, you know, I knew about traditional foods, traditional ecological knowledge. I know that everything I know comes from our Indigenous peoples. Like, they've been using food as medicine for centuries. Mm-hmm. And so it didn't feel right to me running a business that was only serving like one population, really, is what it felt like, this homogeneous population. And so I thought, well, you know, there's a transportation issue. There's an economic issue. There's, do Indigenous people want to eat plant-based whole food? You know, so I started exploring that more. And I said, okay, well, if we can't support the disproportionate rates of diabetes and heart disease that affects Indigenous communities, because they suffer from diabetes and heart disease at 4 to 8 times, even 10 times higher rates than non-Indigenous peoples. And that was also bothering me. I was doing my research in my PhD on this very topic as well. It's what actually drove my dissertation topic. And so we decided to start Sea to Sky Thrivers Society to be the enterprising nonprofit arm of our business. So, which meant that as the Green Mustache made money, profits can go into education programs, not just for Indigenous peoples. And I hate to use the word education because we're not here to educate them. We're actually here to learn from them. So mm-hmm. It was more about just a remembering of the knowledge. And so then the other audience that I found I was always shocked by is how many kids would come in with their parents and eat the food. And I was like, okay, this is brilliant, but not that many children. It was kids of very special parents that mm-hmm. would bring their kids in and who had developed these palates for healthy food. So I knew we had to go into the schools and teach this as well. And then the third audience that we serve through Sea to Sky Thrivers is physicians, because I had a lot of physicians saying, you know, is it safe to eat this many vegetables, or how often can I eat these meals, or why do I have a headache after, I've consumed these meals? And I was like, oh, you're detoxing. And they'd say, what are you detoxing from? What am I detoxing from? And so I realized there was also that need, because I knew the statistics. Physicians receive less than 4 hours of nutrition training in medical school. And not only that, it was one day where a physician said, oh, you don't have to detoxify your body. Like, you know, why would you have to do that? And I said, well, you have all these detoxification pathways in your body. And he was like, no, you don't. And I said, no, well, what is your liver doing?
I was going to say, what is your liver doing, sir?
Yeah, what are your kidneys doing? What are your macrophages doing? And so because I had the science, you know, the biochemistry, the chemistry, biology, I could now actually, I was being hired to train physicians. So we decided to serve those three audiences, because collectively, if our youth, our Indigenous peoples and our physicians understood this information, then this was a massive way to transform the world as well. We would see true healing take place.
That, as you were saying, lots of things are resonating with me, because growing into the role of physician over the last nearly 50 years, I have seen the outcome of complete ignorance on the subject of what food does to you. And I actually went to the website for the Gerson approach, And it's obviously written by, it looks like it's written by a physician who is very conventional and says, well, there aren't any double-blind studies. Of course, you can't do double-blind studies with food because you don't eat it surreptitiously from a needle. You ingest it through your oral cavity. So the kind of resistance that there is within the medical community in a process of transformation like this, which we're talking about transforming the healthcare community so that it is actually health-oriented rather than disease-oriented. The idea that when we talk about healthcare, we're really talking about disease care. And that's been such a focus. Don't come to me until you're sick has been sort of the basic rule that medicine's worked under. And there are some historical reasons for that. But what you're talking about is a whole different thing. It's reaching out into the community, engaging in a mutual learning process, not a we've got the knowledge and we'll give it to you, but we all have knowledge. Let's hear what each of us has to say. You've had physicians support what you're doing. What about sort of the grander structures of medicine, which have been around for a long time and which often are pretty hidebound? They have their own ways of looking at the world. How's that been as you sort of, you're converting one soul at a time, and really they are converted sometimes by their own experiences, but also by what you're doing. What has the response been from sort of the conventional structures of medicine, or do you even have much to do with them?
Oh, I have everything to do with them because when I get a client, I only work with people who have a diagnosed condition. So we have their lab results, you know, their blood work, we have everything. So we know this person is sick. We know that they're on medications, that they probably have surgery coming up, that their prognosis is not good. And so I have to often, you know, I've worked in children's hospital with a 9-year-old who had liver cancer. I've worked, I get all the diagnostic reports from the oncologist. I have to make sure that certain drugs are not trying to suppress the immune system, because what our therapy is doing is the opposite. It is activating the immune system, hormonal system, like all systems. So I have to often have conversations with their medical team. I'm often doing a lot of research on behalf of my clients because they have rare genetic conditions and they have very specific diets. So we have to, get on the same page. I trained physicians. I went to China and trained nearly 600 physicians when I was over there. And so the response is generally amazing, I would say, especially what happened in China, which is a whole nother story. They just took the information and hit the ground running because they have an epidemic right now of diabetes in China that's bankrupting their medical budgets. And so, but then of course, I have definitely been met by the oncologist, the physician who says, diet has nothing to do with this disease. Like they don't have to change their diet. And in fact, I need the person to eat. And this is word for word written in their reports. The patient needs to eat Lay's potato chips, which makes me think, are they sponsored by Lay's? Are they getting kickbacks? So specifically Lay's potato chips, or I have one client right now who's getting absolutely outstanding results for cystic fibrosis, but her team at St. Paul's has been telling her to eat red meat, has been telling her to eat, high amounts of protein, high amounts of estrogen producing foods, high amounts of, you know, like fats, everything, and high amounts of sodium. And that's absolutely the opposite of what she needs, according to the medical literature for cystic fibrosis. And so she's getting exceptional results. So it's, you know, and every once in a while, you know, I get a client, their oncology report says, wow, we've never seen results like this. Keep up the work, keep eating this way. But their original report said their diet had nothing to do with their disease.
You're winning over souls within the profession as well, which is a very constructive thing to do. We just have a few more minutes to go, but I wanted to ask you a little bit about your thoughts about what the model hospital of the future might be like, because you've been doing some thinking about this too.
Yeah, so that is my BHAG, my big, hairy, audacious goal, is to have the hospital of the future called the Richer Health Centers. And these are going to be full-on medical clinics run by medical doctors, nurses, nurse practitioners, and it's going to be an incredible model that will serve all of us. And the hospital of the future needs, first and foremost, to lead with food. That is 100%. So the hospital food is going to be substantially different.
Yes.
And everybody can attest to how terrible hospital food is.
And the studies that show that
the
long
second
use...
part.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead. No.
Sorry. Well, no, studies show that the longer you stay in the hospital, the sicker you will actually
Absolutely.
Become.
Thank you.
Exactly.
Thank you for completing my sentence.
Exactly. Yes. And so it'll lead with food first. And of course, it'll take into consideration the whole human. So nutrification, detoxification is the fastest way to reverse a disease. And then, of course, looking at the human body, so the spirit, the psychology, the family structure, the community. So, you know, looking at things like having gardens be on site, it looks at the, you know, building the microbiome. That's going to be the first thing as well. It looks at getting people off the medications, not on the medications. It is, you know, looking at the person's mental health as well. So breath work, there's going to be compassion and inquiry built into it as opposed to, you know, dictatorship medicine, I call it. And so it is definitely an entire medical model.
Nicolette, we're approaching the end of the show. I want to thank you for bringing forward some concepts that I think are very relevant to the kind of mix of issues that we deal with all the time in the show, which is people having control over the food supply at all levels of their experience. So it's not just when they're healthy and they can make choices easily. It's also at times when they're unwell and they just have to try and find the best path out of the morass of ill health that they find themselves in. So I want to thank you again for being on our show again. We may try and beg you to come back at some point in the future to outline some of the concepts we've been talking about today, because there's even more to talk about. But thank you again, and we'll hope to see you in the future sometime. Thank you.
Definitely. Thank you for having me on the show. Love you.